If you'd like to look to Daniel chapter 3, that's where we're going to spend a good deal of our time at the beginning of the lesson. I'll have most of these passages on the screen, but if you'd like to follow along, you're welcome to do that. There are several of you right now who are involved in a study of the book of Daniel. And one thing that stands out when you go through the book is the overarching theme is God is in charge. And so the first half of the book, you're seeing God in charge on earth. The second half, you're seeing God in charge of heaven. But it doesn't really matter where you are, because what the book of Daniel is showing is that God is going to win. And there are characters, people within the book that are supporting that idea. Obviously, one of them is Daniel. But as we're going to look at this morning, there's also three other young men by the name of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, who are going to support that idea also that God is in charge and that God wins. And as you look at the first part of the book of Daniel, there are very overt actions demonstrating that. God gives Daniel the ability and the others with him to stay healthy when they choose not to defile themselves with the king's food. We see that God gives Daniel the ability to tell the meaning of dreams, to spare the lives of others. We see later that Daniel is thrown into a lion's den, yet God closes the lion's mouths and no harm comes to him. And we see in this account that we'll focus on here in a minute that three young men are cast into a furnace of fire, yet nothing happens to them. And so we see God's power greatly at work. But at the outset, what I want you to understand is this: that these things are typically the exception to the rules. Throughout world history, when the people of God have been thrown into a fire, typically they lose their lives. When the people of God have been thrown to the lions devour the human flesh. It's not often that God is going to choose to make these remarkable scenes known. But here's what we have to understand: that whether you are like Daniel and Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego and experiencing the great power of God that is so visibly manifest, it really doesn't matter in the faith that you can have that if God chooses not to do that, that He still is very much in control. And that eternally speaking, God is going to take care of His people. And so with those thoughts in mind, let's look at this occasion where God is going to come up against a government that has chosen to go against Him. And we're going to see this story very much through the eyes of these young men, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, captives from the land of Israel, who are now living very much within the land of Babylon, the literal land of Babylon, and having to face this ruler who has gotten way above where he needs to be. And so this account begins with King Nebuchadnezzar, the emperor of the day, the one who's in charge of really the superpower of the earth, who decides to make a decree about religion. It's not an uncommon thing that leaders will oftentimes commandeer religion as a way of advancing their own power. And so that's what we see here, beginning in verse 1 of Daniel 3. Where it says, King Nebuchadnezzar made an image of gold, whose height was 60 cubits and its breadth 6 cubits. He set it up on the plain of Dura in the province of Babylon. Then King Nebuchadnezzar sent to gather the satraps, the prefects, and the governors, the counselors, the treasurers, the justices, the magistrates, and all the officials of the provinces to come to the dedication of the image that King Nebuchadnezzar had set up. You'll notice that this chapter does a lot of lists, but there's a reason for that. The writer is making us realize that everybody who's anybody is there. And so here he goes again through all those who are present, verse 3, the satraps, the prefects, the governors, the counselors, the treasurers, the justices, the magistrates, and all the officials of the provinces gathered for the dedication of the image that King Nebuchadnezzar had set up. And they stood before the image that King Nebuchadnezzar had set up. It's a united government. The king has ordered all of his lessers to join with him in this worship to this grand statue at his command. And so the lessers understand exactly where their bread is buttered, and they all gather to do that, but they're not by themselves, because what we're going to see is that the people are going to readily agree to do this also. So we pick up in verse 4. And the herald proclaimed aloud, "You are commanded, O peoples, nations, and languages." Same terminology we'll have going all the way to the book of Revelation while they're dealing with their own Nebuchadnezzar and Babylon. "You are commanded that when you hear the sound of the horn, the pipe, lyre, trigon, harp, bagpipe, and every kind of music, you are to fall down and worship the golden image that King Nebuchadnezzar has set up." And just in case anybody's thinking about dissenting, verse 6, "Whoever does not fall down and worship shall immediately be cast into the fiery furnace. Therefore, as soon as all the people heard the sound of the horn, the pipe, the lyre, trigon, harp, bagpipe, and every kind of music, all the peoples, nations, and languages fell down and worshiped the golden image that King Nebuchadnezzar had set up." We see an interesting thing about people. Whether you lived in that day or whether you live in the 21st century, most people have a heads-down attitude toward the government. No one wants to get noticed. Nobody wants to be on the radar screen. And the very best way to do that is simply to comply without fighting, without doing anything that would alert the leaders to the fact that you're not in full obedience. And so that's why you can oftentimes have a dictator who may literally control millions of people, because the majority of the millions of people simply want to live their lives without notice of the government. And so here they are, they're all bowing down. But yet, what do we find? We find that there's three who are going to take a stand. And I've often tried to visualize this in my mind, that as you're standing here with this gargantuan statue in front of you, and the king having given the orders that you bow down or you die, and everybody else bowing down, that here are these three somewhat towering figures themselves, though much shorter than the statue. Yet they're standing while everyone else is kneeling. And as often the case, you'll have the people who are trying to get in good favor with the leader who go and they report this. And they say, "You got three Jews here who you've brought in, and they're leaders amongst us, but they're not obeying you. They're not doing what you told them to do." And this makes Nebuchadnezzar very angry. And so we look, picking up in verse 12, at the description of what's about to happen. And here's the report: "There are certain Jews whom you have appointed over the affairs of the province of Babylon, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. These men, O king, pay no attention to you. They do not serve your gods or worship the golden image that you have set up." If you're a monarch, a dictator, an autocrat, it's not often that you have people who stand up to you. And yet here are three of your own officials who are doing that very thing. So Nebuchadnezzar, we're told, in a furious rage. Here is a man who has been defied. Here is a man who has said, "Do this," and three have not done it. And he commanded that Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego be brought. So they brought these men before the king. Nebuchadnezzar answered and said to them, "Is it true, O Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, that you do not serve my gods or worship the golden image that I have set up? Now, if you're ready, when you hear the sound of the horn, pipe, lyre, trigon, harp, bagpipe, and every kind of music, to fall down and worship the image that I have made, well and good." Now let's stop there for a minute. King's furious, but maybe they've been misunderstood. Maybe they didn't hear the orchestra strike up. Maybe it was they didn't hear the herald's proclamation. So he says, "We'll let bygones be bygones, but when the band starts playing, you hit your knees to this statue." But just in case, that I've misunderstood and that you really are defying me. If you do not worship, you shall immediately be cast into a burning fiery furnace. And who is the God who will deliver you out of my hands? And we need to hear an echo across the Old Testament as we think about the serpent in the Garden of Eden, Pharaoh in Egypt. Here is our new snake who is saying, I am the one who deserves your allegiance, and there is no God who can stand up to me. Obviously wasn't aware of Pharaoh and all that happened there, but this new serpent has laid down the gauntlet. And as he rejects God, these three are going to reject Babylon, towering above the others. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego answered and said to the king, O Nebuchadnezzar, we have no need to answer you in this matter. If this be so, our God, whom we serve, is able to deliver us from the burning fiery furnace, and he will deliver us out of your hand, O king. But if not, let it be known to you, O king, that we will not serve your gods or worship the gold image that you have set up. May I remind you, this is not a kid's story. These are three men who are looking the superpower of the world square in the eyes and saying, we're going to serve our God. And our God has full ability to save us. We don't know if he will or not in this physical sense. Maybe he won't. But whatever the case, we're not bowing. But I want you to note how they did it. First of all, it was done very respectfully. You've got them acknowledging his authority, his power, his position here. They're not going out trying to find a rebel group to join with to overthrow King Nebuchadnezzar. They're looking the king square in the eyes, and they're saying, we recognize your power. There is no disrespect that they're showing in the words that they're using to him. But we also see that they are resolute in this. I wonder if amongst some of those people bowing to this gold image were saying, I have no belief in this thing. But to keep out of the eyes of Nebuchadnezzar, I'm going to bow down, but in my mind, I'm really worshiping my own God. It wouldn't surprise me if that was the case. Someone who says, I'm just going to pretend it's not really going to be in my heart, that's not them. The king says, who is the God who can save you? And they say, O king, sir, let us tell you about this God who can save us. And they were unswerving. Kill us if you must. It's not going to change our minds. We're not going to do what you tell us to do. We refuse to bow to your command. Because what you've done is you've tried to take the place of God, and that just simply doesn't work. We know the rest of the story, don't we? King throws them in the fiery furnace. Heavenly being appears there with them. Nebuchadnezzar's amazed. He takes them out. They don't even smell of smoke. Here is this grand display of God's power, and Nebuchadnezzar confesses his belief in God and says, only this God can be worshipped. God wins, which is the theme of the book of Daniel. But for the remainder of our time this morning, I want us to focus on how these three dealt with a government that was encouraging them to do something that they did not do, that they knew was wrong to do. And we'll put that in the context of, what if you and I are called on to bow to some power that is standing in opposition to what we know is right, and that power is calling on us to abandon what we know is right to do what's wrong? These three set the example of that. I'm going to be a little bit repetitious from last week's sermon. But I don't think that's a bad thing in this case. I do believe it's a reminder we need fairly regularly in our country. And that is, just like these three men, we are to be respectful. Even in times of opposition, we are respectful of those things. I think about Peter as he was writing to the people of God in his day. Near the end of his letter, he's talking about where he is. And he said, or where the people of God are. And he says, "She who is at Babylon, who is likewise chosen, sends you greeting. So does Mark, my son." Now, we put our world history to the task. We know that by the point Peter's writing, Babylon is long gone. It's in the history books. So why would Peter purposely bring that name back up again, likely as a synonym for Rome here? It's because when you go from Genesis 11 through the rest of the Bible, Babylon becomes the archetype of the enemy of God, the one who's always standing in opposition, whether you're at the Tower of Babel, the Tower of Babylon, or whether you're on the plain of Dura, or whether you're sitting on Patmos with John, who's been exiled. Babylon is representing what's against God. And so here is Peter, as he's writing, he's saying, I want to tell you how you deal with being a Christian in situations where you are in submission to someone who is not a Christian. And so he talks about wives with unbelieving husbands. And he talks about servants to unbelieving masters. And he talks about citizens to an unbelieving government. And so as we pointed out last week, when we become Christians, our politics change. Our politics are now heavenward, right? We're citizens of the kingdom of heaven. Yet, what does the Lord say through Peter? He says, you be subject for the Lord's sake to every institution, whether it be to the emperor as supreme or to governors as sent to punish those who do evil and to praise those who do good. For this is the will of God, that by doing good, you should put to silence the ignorance of foolish people. Live as people who are free, not using your freedom as a cover-up for evil, but living as servants of God. Honor everyone. Love the brotherhood. Fear God. Honor the emperor. What's Peter saying? He's saying that as a citizen of the kingdom of God, your king has said be subject to these lesser powers. And not only subject, but respectful to them. You give them honor. Now we think about the ramifications of that. What that's saying is that we're a whole lot like Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. We're not finding some rebel group that's going to move out. You think about those of Peter's day, the zealots who are ready to go against Rome, or a group of Jews who moved out to the middle of the wilderness because they thought things had just gotten too bad. And so you got one group who's trying to rebel and you got another group that's moved away, and Peter is saying, no. You live amongst them so that your example is shining. And here, when the government is supporting good, you're going to stand out because you're doing the right thing. And those who are trying to accuse you of wrong, they're going to be put to shame. You don't rebel. And you don't diminish. I've mentioned before, we sometimes think it's our American right to speak out against the government. Well, I'm not saying we can't disagree. It's all right to hold a different financial idea than maybe some officials do. But what this is saying is that when someone hears my words, or we want to fast forward Peter about 2,000 years, and someone is looking at my footprint on social media, they had better not ever get the impression that I am a rebel against the government. Because that is explicitly contradicting what Peter is saying of be subject and show honor. Yet how easy it is for us to fall from our heavenly citizenship back down to an earthly view, and we get caught up in all of the politics, a party and elections and all of this, and we suddenly start talking like someone who has not been transformed into the kingdom of the dear Son. Peter says, stop. Don't do that. You be respectful. Whether it be your spoken word, the conversations you're having with others, or whether it be what people are looking at that's associated with you, you make sure that everybody's recognizing you as a force of good, not your own good, but because you've been put into that kingdom of the dear Son. Yet with all of that, we also understand that like these three young men, we very much need to be resolute in beliefs. I want to take us again to the first century. And as John is beginning the book of Revelation, I've taken parts from letters to three different churches here: Pergamon, Thyatira, Philadelphia. But I want you to note the commonality here between them. Revelation 2, 13 and 25, and then over in chapter 3, verse 11, I know where you dwell. This is Jesus speaking to these Christians, where Satan's throne is, yet you hold fast my name. And you did not deny my faith even in the days of Antipas, my faithful witness, who was killed among you where Satan dwells. Only hold fast what you have until I come. I am coming soon. Hold fast to what you have. We're seeing a trend, aren't we? That idea of holding fast, we would say, grab on with everything you got. You're not letting anything pull you away from this, and that is the resolve that we need to have. So what we've got to realize is that if we are not awfully careful, the culture in which we live can have very subtle influences upon us. We consider this not from the fact, like the people in the first century or of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. You and I don't live under an emperor. At the present time, we have zero fear that some leader is going to send people out to close our doors. That's just beyond right now of what we would consider. What we do have to understand is this, though. We do face an enforcement by our society, by our culture at the moment. And oftentimes the word that is used here is tolerance, that there is an enforced tolerance. And that being said, that you are going to tolerate all these different ideas and groups and such that are out there. But before we go too far with that terminology, we need to stop and think for a minute about a very important question. And that question is, aren't Christians supposed to be tolerant? The answer to that is absolutely yes. We are to be a very tolerant people. Let me just show you a couple of examples. I go back to the King James Version for the language here because it's so much more accurate in pinpointing the idea. When Paul's writing to Timothy, he says, preach the word, be instant in season, out of season, reprove, rebuke, exhort with all long suffering. Don't you like that term? That you are suffering long with someone? Well, that's tolerance, isn't it? Here's someone who has a wrong idea. Here is someone who is in violation of the Word of God. Here is someone who is practicing something that goes against the morality of God. But yet, as Paul writes to Timothy and consequently the lesson to us, he's saying, you suffer long with that person. You don't give up. You don't start treating that person like an enemy. And that's where the Apostle Paul picks up. And he says in Romans 12, beginning in verse 19, beloved, never avenge yourselves, but leave it to the wrath of God. For it is written, vengeance is mine, I will repay, says the Lord. To the contrary, if your enemy is hungry, feed him. If he's thirsty, give him something to drink. For by so doing, you are heaping burning coals on his head. Do you let that verse bring the peace to your mind that it needs to? What the apostle is saying is, you're not the enforcer. You're not the punisher. Your job is to go out and let people see the goodness of God through you. And so here's someone who's hungry, here's someone who's thirsty, here's someone in need, and maybe they have very different politics than you, or maybe they have a very different lifestyle than you, or maybe they've got a different skin color than you, or they're from another country than you are. And Paul says, feed them if they're hungry. That's our job. But now let's go back to what he told Timothy. We're still preaching, aren't we? We're still reproving and rebuking and exhorting, but it's done not from the Spirit where we're standing as judges and enforcers, but rather as those who are doing good, not because everybody is going to be amazed by our piety, but because they're going to see in us someone who is changed. Someone who is humble enough to say, I am going to do good and I'll leave vengeance to God. So I believe it's more like this. Let's leave the word tolerance off and change it to this. We faced enforced acceptance. And so the pressure that we're feeling at the moment is that if you don't go along with the popular beliefs on some of the more hot-button issues, such as abortion has been in the news lately, transgenderism, especially as relating to kids. We've got the whole concept of gay marriage again before our Congress. The pressure that we're finding is that if you don't accept society's standards, there's a problem. You see, we tolerate. None of us had better start forming organizations to go out like a bunch of vigilantes against these groups. We tolerate in the sense that here are people who may believe those things, yet I'm going to do good, and in the process, hopefully get that opportunity to let the light of God shine in. But we realize that that enforced acceptance is very much pushed in our media. Whether that be the news that you're watching, more likely, if it's the programming that you're watching, it's not a full-out assault all the time. Sometimes it's more of the attrition of wearing down the convictions that we need to hold. There was a primetime television program very recently that was dealing with homosexuality. And one of the lines that one of the characters spoke was something like, there are things that we used to think were terrible, but now we realize maybe just aren't so bad after all. That's attrition. That's the wearing down. That's the acceptance. And so while we would never look at a young woman who has gotten herself into a bad situation with a pregnancy, and she's trying to make that decision, we're not going to go against her. We're not going to treat her horribly. In fact, just the opposite. But we're not going to allow that sentiment to say, well, maybe it's okay to take a life. Or if here are two people who are just as happy as can be, is it really my place to say they're wrong? Well, no, it's not my place. It's God's place. I treat people well, no matter their choices, yet I'm not letting my guard down either. And what we've seen over the past 5 years or so is that this is leading many religious groups to lessen their convictions. I'm not going to call names, but I was shocked. And that doesn't happen very often anymore. When a certain religious group in the past 2 weeks came out and said, you know, we're not going to be against gay marriage. We don't like it, but we're not going to be against it. This is one of the most conservative, morally conservative groups. That's what we're seeing. And a whole lot of that is because of this ever-present danger that we've termed the canceling. Whether you're a celebrity, whether you're a church, whether you're a group, whatever, if you don't follow the enforced acceptance, we're going to consider you a non-being, a non-entity. And that's what a lot of people are running from. They're afraid of that. Which leads us to the final. And that is, we're resolute in this, but we're also unswerving. We love everybody, treat everybody well. But we're not going to be worn down by society. We better not be. I don't know what's going to happen. We may be on the cusp, maybe, of a little bit more than indirect persecution. And I use persecution very loosely here. The canceling and such as that, that one might experience. And why do I say that? Well, the reason I say that is when you start looking right now in real time at other, quote, free speech nations, we're beginning to see the government doing some mild punishing. Nothing really more now than a slap on the wrist for most. And I'm not going to bring any of those situations up this morning, but just simply say, I have a keen interest when I hear about a preacher being arrested. That gets my attention. And I've been seeing some of that. In nations where we would think that ought not to happen. Now, there may be a backstory that I'm unfamiliar with that would change my mind, but what I could read was not. And we're finding that even in some countries, if a celebrity, in fact, recently a sports star came out and said something and was arrested for it. Again, maybe a backstory there, but from what was shown, the enforced acceptance seems to be getting the attention of the governing officials to bring down a punishment for those who reject it. So, how far is that from us? I have no idea. It's like I said last week, it may be a storm cloud on the horizon that never materializes into a storm. But we watch and we see that kind of thing is happening, and likely what we'll begin to see is some of those slap on the wrist kinds of things. Church loses its tax-exempt status if it does not go with the enforced acceptance. Preachers, I don't know if you know this or not, but the government's very kind as far as taxes go. A lot of things that can be deducted likely will be taken away, and that's okay, right? We can survive. But what we realize is what begins small sometimes can get big, but before we get too far down that road, we don't borrow trouble from the future. I always hesitate a little bringing a sermon like this because I don't want it to ever be a hand-wringing, things are terrible, things are falling apart, what are we going to do kind of experience. That's not the idea. And we pray that they don't come. But we make sure we're prepared if they do come. I can assure you of this. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego didn't all of a sudden decide on the plain of Dura, you know, I think we won't bow down. That was an established thing. An idea that they had already formulated that nothing would come between them and their God. And so when the pressure was turned on, there really wasn't a decision to make there. They had already made that decision. That's what we've got to do. Regardless of whether we get some slap on the wrist, regardless of whether we really see the storm clouds brewing, whatever the case, we're like these three. We have no need to answer you, O King. The God we serve can save us, but if He doesn't, we will not bow. We're respectful, but we will not bow the knee. And that's exactly what we see of the faithful of the first century. The Babylon of their day, who's turning on the pressure. Look at all of those things. What the Lord's saying to these different people when He says, do not fear what you're about to suffer. Behold, the devil is about to throw some of you into prison that you may be tested, and for 10 days. I wonder where they got that from. That's the 10 days of testing from Daniel being brought forward to make us understand. You will have tribulation. Be faithful unto death. It'll be worth it. I'll give you a crown of life. We go down. He who has an ear, let him hear what the Spirit says to the churches. The one who conquers will not be hurt by the second death. You'll be okay. And they have conquered him by the blood of the Lamb and by the word of their testimony, for they love not their lives even unto death. He will wipe away every tear from their eyes, and death shall be no more. Neither shall there be mourning, nor crying, nor pain anymore, for the former things have passed away. But then look at the final passage that we find coming from chapter 21. But as for the cowardly, the first in line for the second death, those who are not unswerving, those who, when the pressure is turned on, they bow the knee, their portion will be in the lake that burns with fire and sulfur, which is the second death. Jesus says, I've got this under control. You got to trust me. And so then, what we understand is that we depend on Him regardless of whether that's going to be this really overt thing like with Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, or whether we die in the process or whatever might happen. We trust. But let me also add, it means we understand the importance of spiritual community. Last week I told you the first two lessons in this series might not look like they fit. We're making that turn now. That what we have got to understand is that if the pressure is turned on, we need each other. And we are not talking about some squishy dish rag kind of relationship. We are going to need the solid, loving, trusting relationship of people who are built up by the faith of others. Probably any one of those three men would have stood all alone if the situation had been that they were separated from the others. But there was strength in being able to look and to see, I'm not the only one. There are others who've made the same commitment as me. And if that day of testing does come for us, the strength we're going to find in each other is going to be paramount in helping us not to bow the knee. And so what I'd like to do for the next several lessons is to talk about how we develop that kind of community that's going to be able to stand strong if that time should come. But I guess the word that we would sum up this lesson and that it to come is prepared. That's what we've got to be. We've talked about people who have declared their faith this morning and put to the test. That should never be a detriment for someone considering coming to God. Someone may be saying, well, I don't think I want to get involved in all that. No, what God's saying is, you may go through a time of testing here, but in passing that test, there is a reward beyond your wildest imagination waiting. The relationship with me, the crown of faith, standing with me for eternity. It's worth whatever you go through here. And so far from discouraging, I would say to those of you who are considering becoming a Christian, this should encourage you. That no matter what happens, when you belong to the kingdom of the dear Son has always got your best interest at heart. So don't delay. Take time this morning to make the best decision you'll ever make. And that's to say, I want to be a part of this kingdom. I want my citizenship in heaven. I want the protection of God, understanding that there is no force on earth or heaven other than my own free will, which can take me from the safety of salvation in God. So if you're considering that decision this morning, I would encourage you to follow through. You can come forward. You can find me afterwards. Or maybe you're feeling your faith a little shaky. If you'd like for us to pray with you, that's what a spiritual community does, because we all understand it. And we'll go with you to God in prayer. If you're ready to prepare for what promises to be an eternity beyond description. I encourage you to follow through with that decision, and you can do so while we sing together.